You're listening to 10 Points, a podcast with your hosts, Ash and Nicholas, where all the talk is Canadian Highlander, our favorite format from the best trading card game ever, Magic the Gathering.
Hey everyone, it's me, Ash.
And me, Nicholas.
Today we're going to be talking about how we evaluate cards for Canadian Highlander.
But first, of course, we're going to do our best card from, and today we're on Odyssey. So Ash, what's your best card from Odyssey?
So I have an honorable mention. Actually, I have two honorable mentions before we get to our actual votes. One of them is Deserted Temple, a notable friend of Talarian Academy. It is a colorless land that says one tap, untap target land. So you get to untap your Talarian Academy and do all sorts of unfair things with that. And my other honorable mention is Peak. I've talked about it a million times. I love the card, and it is in this set. But my real vote for the best card for Canadian Highlander is probably going to have to be Tainted Pact. It interacts very favorably with Thassa's Oracle, which we're going to talk about a little bit later, actually. And it's very, it's been used on the points list for even longer than Oracle's been around. So it's been a classic card for the format.
Yeah, card's great. My best card from is going to be Entomb. It's
speaking of black cards that get cards out of your deck.
Yeah, it's really, really good in Storm decks. It's good in Reanimator decks. Pretty much any decks where you need a specific card in your graveyard, Entomb is your card. And then a couple other honorable mentions. Careful Study sees a solid amount of play. It also happens to be pretty good in both of the decks that I just mentioned that Entomb goes in. And Barbarian Ring is a good red deck wins card.
Yeah, no, this format, this set had quite a lot of new printings, not that many good ones. A lot of cards that had the word ATOG on them, though, so that's
fun. Oh, yeah. I love me some ATOG art.
Okay, so let's dive right into it if you're ready.
Yeah.
We're going to be talking about card evaluation, how we evaluate not only new cards, but how we look back and evaluate older cards as new cards come out. We've kind of broken it down into a couple different questions we ask ourselves about the new cards, which I'm just going to kind of rapid fire through them real quick, and then we'll go into them a little more in depth one at a time. The first is if it just goes straight into something. The second is if it supports a given deck's game plan. The third is, does it give rise to a new deck or archetype? The fourth is it consistently good? And then the last is a little more flexible, and it's more discussion about meta, which we'll get into a bit later. But Nick, do you want to kind of give some example or get in a little bit to our first question?
Yeah. So does it go straight into something? This is obviously the most basic point. Is it just really good in a deck? So usually like a strict upgrade on a deck's game plan. A good example that Ash brought up earlier is it was Activated Sleeper, right?
Yeah, Activated Sleeper. Yeah,
Activated Sleeper. It's a new card, newer card, and it just goes straight into Protean Hulk. The deck was playing cards that filled that role that were less efficient, and it was just strictly more efficient and just went straight into the deck without much thought really having to be had.
Yeah, namely what it did is it took the effect that I believe was originally filled by Body Double and then later a different 4-mana card that actually brings back the Hulk and replaced it with a 3-mana option, so you get more pips to spend on other effects in your Hulk piles. And obviously, this is a straight upgrade, and that is very good for the deck. It technically has a little tiny requirement that the thing had to die this turn, but 9 times out of 10, it doesn't matter in Hulk. So obviously, that's very good specifically for Hulk. Another thing that it provides is, in this example, if you wanted to have additional cards, for example, if they were to mill you or cause you to get a card exiled, for example, with Ragavan or something, you might want to have redundant copies of effects in your deck. So this gets to be an upgrade on a redundant effect or just a redundant effect in general. So sometimes, like, let's say, for example, a new card was printed that was not exactly the same, but pretty similar to Thassa's Oracle. Well, every Oracle deck would probably want to play it if it worked with the same combos, because it's just an additional copy of a card you really, really want to acquire.
I think you just described Laboratory Maniac.
Well, more like the Jace, the 4-mana Jace.
Sure.
Maybe that's a poor example because this came out like the same time, but it is one big thing we look for is, does it go straight into something that will utilize it immediately without like necessarily overhauling the deck or anything? And will it get to be a strict upgrade or additional redundancy that a deck is wanting?
Yeah, I would agree. Like we said, that one's kind of the most straightforward.
A little obvious, you could say.
Yeah, but it's worth mentioning. The second one is much more vague, and this is, I think, probably where a lot of people have a hard time assessing cards, which is, does it support a deck's game plan? But even further than that, is it better than what's already there? And I think the problem that a lot of people have when new cards come out is they're like, oh yeah, this like seems like it would fit this deck's game plan. But a lot of the times, it's just not, there's not an open slot that it can fill. Because the problem with Canlander is the bar is set really high for card quality. It's hard for a new card to be better than what already exists unless it's like really supporting a deck's game plan in a way that either it's not being supported or is just better than one of the cards that already is in the deck.
Yeah, I think we saw that happen actually with the new Thrun, the like 5-mana Thrun. Aside from the fact that it's not better than the 4-mana Thrun, I saw a couple people playing the 5-mana Thrun and basically replacing cards in their deck that are just like better 5 drops most of the time. I saw someone playing it and I said, oh, you have room for 2 5 drops because you're playing that and the 5-mana Vivian, right? And like, oh, I'm not playing the 5-mana Vivian. I'm like, I don't remember the exact deck, but I remember thinking, I think you're just kind of wrong to not be playing Vivian and instead be playing this new card.
Yeah, which I think the new Thrun has actually proved itself to be pretty solid.
I recall that deck wanting to be playing the Vivian. Sure. Maybe the example would hold a little more weight had I remembered the archetype.
Yeah. Like if you're playing like some sort of creature toolbox deck or something, you probably want to be playing the Vivian over Thrun.
Right.
But I know like at least in like Naya monsters or like red green monsters kind of decks, Thrun has been pretty solid.
Yeah. That's fair.
Yeah. And then the next point for if it supports a deck's game plan is, does it provide redundancy that the deck needs? So it doesn't necessarily have to be better than cards that it's already playing. Like, for example, right now for like 1-mana hand attack, you've got Duress, Inquisition, and Thoughtseize, and those are the good ones. Like, that's, you're really not playing anything further than that because they're not good. But if like Wizards printed a new 1-mana hand attack spell that was like actually good, you'd probably find just including it with the three basic hand attack spells as opposed to thinking, huh, is it better than one of these? You can just,
yeah, I think, oh sorry,
I was just gonna say, you can throw it right alongside them in there.
I think this most often comes up with mid-range decks, or maybe like control-y mid-range decks too, but like what will happen is a new like decently efficient threat will come out or a new piece of interaction will come out and people are like, oh, this is an efficient spot removal spell, I'm gonna put it in my mid-rangey deck. And then the deck already has say 9 pieces of spot removal and the deck may not really want more pieces of spot removal, so it may be fine, but is it worth removing your density of threats? Is it worth removing your card advantage engines? Is it worth taking out a better piece of removal? I think that's where this happens most often. You know, some removal spells will be making the rounds in Standard and Pioneer, but do we really want those in Canlander? I think it's not always the case.
Yeah. A good example, I actually just went to our Discord and kind of scrolled through the new card section to see if there are any new cards that like kind of fell into that category. And Bitter Triumph is one that it's a new card that someone had been like, hey, I guess for anyone that doesn't know what it does, it's one in a black for an instant that says, as an additional cost to cast the spell, discard a card or pay 3 life and destroy target creature or planeswalker. And they're like, hey, does this seem good in like mid-range decks and stuff? And it's one of those things where like the card seems fine, but it's just not better than what's already there. Like the downside is worse than the upside, and except for maybe like a few very specific decks, like Reanimator probably likes it. But
yeah.
It's one of those things where you can't just look at the card. You have to look at what already exists.
I think an example of something that would be on the other side of that coin is a new card that came out, or it just came out, I suppose, is Mephitic. I'm going to spell it wrong. I think it's Mephitic Drought. Draught. It's a potion thing. It's one in a black for an artifact. When it enters the battlefield or is put into a graveyard from the battlefield, you draw a card and lose a life. A lot of decks don't want that, but a lot of the like Goblin Welder decks or Eggs decks, Ichor Wellspring is low-key that deck's favorite card. So getting to play a second one, while it is worse, it has a black mana in it and you lose life, those decks are probably still going to want to play it because of the value they gain from sacrificing artifacts. So even though this one is worse, it leans into that redundancy that the deck wants. And I think that's the reason this one will see value in those types of decks.
Yeah. I would agree.
Okay. Do you have any other comments on the support text game plan? I feel like we're probably going to be referencing these things back as we go, because we're gonna, you know, probably talk about some cards as well.
Yeah, for sure.
See where they fit into stuff.
Yeah. No, I think I'm good to move on to the next category, which is this one is I would say fairly difficult to see upon release, but it's the kind of thing that manifests as the card has been out for a bit. But it's, does it birth a new deck?
I would actually also think, before we get too far into it, is I think this is the topic that often has the most most people are most invested in the discussion about this, because people love to see new decks become a thing.
Yeah.
Especially when we've been waiting on it.
Yeah, because like Canlander is a super diverse format, but they're like a lot of the decks are just kind of like timeless things that have been around forever. And the decks have like changed and stuff throughout time, but a lot of the time they are very, like, you see a lot of the same decks over many years. But then every once in a while you get a card like Thassa's Oracle or Underworld Breach that just kind of creates an entire new deck or just completely shifts the game plan of an existing deck. And so this one's like, it's pretty hard to see those cards on release and determine, like, I don't think Breach Storm became a thing until not crazy long after it came out, but it wasn't like immediate, like when it was spoiled, I don't think people were necessarily predicting it being better than what it already existed as the Storm deck in the format, using Yawgmoth's Will.
I think I'm gonna have to fight you a little bit on that, because I think what actually happened was people did go straight for it. I mean, it was actually, I don't know if you know this, but it was the fastest print to point card so far. But I think they weren't trying to replace like the traditional Storm deck with it. they decided to build a Breach Storm decks, which over the next couple weeks, they just kind of converged. I think that's what happened.
Yeah. I don't remember people. Yeah, I don't remember people talking about it being its own deck.
Sure. For what it's worth, Oracle came out in the same set.
Sure.
So I think people were a little distracted.
Yeah. Oracle's one of those cards that, every once in a while, you get a card that just completely shifts the format, and Oracle was that until it got pointed to 7.
Now, and as much as I think a lot of people really hated playing against Oracle, this episode is not about evaluating cards on if we like them or not.
Yeah.
It's evaluating them on their ability to hold their own in the format. And I think everyone pretty immediately knew that Thassa's Oracle is going to be huge. Part of that is because of the implications of CEDH. We knew the combos as soon as it came out. And we knew that this is a two-card combo that is very easy to tutor for and very hard to interact with. We've seen the power of that with Flash Hulk. And now it just gets to go into a control shell.
Yeah.
So I think everyone pretty immediately knew, because while it didn't... It kind of went straight into something. It went straight into the Time Vault decks, because most of the tutors got... Well, I should say some of the tutors overlapped pretty well. And it pretty quickly became obvious that it was very good. Go ahead.
I was just gonna say, I don't remember seeing it as much in the Time Vault decks, but like the Doomsday decks were just like eating it up, which even now today there's still a few Doomsday Oracle lists running around. But when Oracle was 0 points, I mean, really, it's not even a matter of which decks were playing it. Pretty much all of the decks were playing it. If you could, you just like threw it in the deck because it was so good.
Yeah, there was like no downside, basically.
Yeah, because Flash Hulk, even though it is very strong, the problem with that is that you have to dilute your deck with some questionably bad cards. But Thassa's Oracle, you really don't, apart from Oracle, which isn't great unless you're winning with it.
But if you just draw Oracle, then you have half your combo. Yeah. So, I think now this is the part of the conversation that I think gets a lot of people very excited to brew and talk about new possibilities, which is when a new card comes out, does it allow a new deck to form by providing density? So it's not like, oh, Oracle came out and now this Oracle deck is a thing. It's, oh, we finally got enough Soul Warden effects to build Soul Sisters. We finally got enough good, efficiently costed zombies to build Zombie Tribal. We finally got enough artifacts you want to sacrifice and ways to sacrifice them to build a, what do they call it? Arista Scraps, I think is what they call it.
I've never heard of that. That's awesome.
So you can play the artifact sacrificing Goblin Welder kind of deck. Those, I think, are the more fun discussions, and I think that's what people really love about when new stuff comes out, is seeing things that we've almost had come to fruition.
Yeah.
Longtime show listeners might recall the Merfolk tribal thing that happened, which is, a couple new Merfolk have been coming out for a couple years, and I've been talking about how I think Merfolk tribal's there, and then I built it, but I think I built it really bad, and it was just bad.
Yeah. What were you going to say?
I was going to say, I think Merfolk tribal is like actually real now that Ixalan came out.
I didn't even think about that. I haven't looked at
There's like four legitimately good Merfolk. Yeah. And listen. Imagine if it's Bitter Blossom, but they're hexproof.
And Merfolk, presumably.
Yeah, so whenever you have a Merfolk become tapped, a non-token Merfolk become tapped, you get a Merfolk.
Wait, whenever a non-token Merfolk becomes tapped, you get a Merfolk?
Yeah, it might be once a turn.
Once a turn makes a lot more sense. Otherwise, that seems Wild.
Okay, hold on. You just entertain the audience for a moment.
I guess just to continue elaborating on this point, I think there are a lot of decks in Canlander that are like right on the edge of being playable. Merfolk is a good example. Zombies is another good example, though that one may be a little bit further. And so anytime one of those decks gets an improvement, like Ash said, people get really excited because you can kind of like try to piece the deck together now and be like, okay, so what is it still missing? And if the answer is nothing, then you've got a deck. I think there's just something about tribal that people really enjoy. And so when people see their favorite tribe getting support, I know we've had a Slivers tribal player on the on Paperlander at one point.
Okay, so it is called Deeproot Pilgrimage. It is one and a blue for an enchantment. Whenever one or more non-token merfolk you control become tapped, create a 1/1 blue merfolk creature token with hexproof.
Okay, yeah, one or more is a very important distinction.
Yeah, true, but you could just play Smuggler's Copter.
Sure. Yes. I mean, the card's still really, really good in merfolk. Yeah. My initial thought was, if it was just whenever a merfolk becomes tapped, and you just attack with, four merfolk, then the game is, over.
And there's some other good ones. We don't have to... I don't even know what I'm saying. I was going to say, we don't necessarily have to talk about the merfolk, but honestly, I'm kind of interested in talking about the merfolk, because there's some legit good merfolk in this set. I know because I played Pioneer the other week and kind of got wrecked.
Sure.
Like, here's a 2-drop 1/2 ETB and Explorers, which is fine. There was one 1-drop one, I think, that was really good. But now I can't see it, so clearly I am wrong. Oh, this is the good one. You ready? It's 2 and a blue for a 3/2. It's Tashana's Tidebinder. It has flash. 3-drop 3/2 flash. When it enters the battlefield, you stifle, and if an ability of an artifact, creature, or planeswalker is countered this way, that permanent loses all abilities as long as this creature's in play.
That sounds like a medium blue staple to me.
Yeah, it is, probably. But it's just, kind of great.
Yeah, that's super cool.
Let's see. There's a... No, that one's not that good. And then those are just the blue ones. I'm sure there's some good green ones too. I'll update you if I find them. But again, we don't have to get too much. Oh, there's a 1-drop. There's a green 1-drop of ETB and Explorers.
So while Ash tries to make Merfolk good again,
Merfolk wasn't good. But we're not going to try and make Merfolk great again.
No, I'm not saying make Merfolk the deck good again. I'm saying that you are again trying to make Merfolk good.
Oh. I understand.
Yes.
I see. Yo, wait, hold on. This one's actually kind of, it's mid actually. It's X and a green for a 1/1 ETB Explores X times.
Wait, it's like not. It's what? 1 and X?
Yeah, X and green. It explores X times. So I mean, it could just be a 1 mana 1/1, or it could explore for more mana.
That's interesting.
It's not the worst top deck.
Maybe. Everyone build Merfolk. And post your lists in the comments.
There's another 1-drop 1/1. You can pay 3 and make it explore as a sorcery. Oh, this one's legit good. It's 3 mana for a 3/4 with vigilance. Whenever it enters the battlefield or attacks, you make a map token.
What do map tokens do?
1 tap, sack, explore.
So Merfolk Tribal is also just explore tribal now, seemingly.
There's another 2-drop one, whatever. Okay, I'm not gonna get into it. I know I said that 5 minutes ago and we've been talking about Merfolk this whole time, but I'm just saying, Merfolk, like I said, this set I think was finally the breakthrough set for Merfolk. Someone build it, send me a list. But you know, all that to say, I think it's the most exciting when new decks get to finally become a thing.
Yeah.
I think everyone likes when new interesting decks, you know. I don't know how many people liked it when Thassa's Oracle became a thing, but
well, I mean, the people playing Thassa's Oracle quite enjoyed it.
I had multiple people tell me they wish it didn't exist, but they liked winning. So
sure, that's fair. I am proud to say I still to this day have never sleeved up a Thassa's Oracle deck.
Really?
Yep. Even when it came out, especially when it came out, I didn't want to play it just because it was what everyone else was doing and it was boring. And
I mean, your response was just don't play blue, so you're not obligated to play it.
No, I played a decent bit of blue. I just didn't put Thassa's Oracle in my deck.
Wow. Okay.
And I just still haven't. I mean, I'm not even opposed to playing it now. I just haven't gotten around to it, I suppose.
Fair enough. Okay, well, Nicholas, I would like you to tell me, explain a little bit about what consistently good means and how we evaluate cards on it.
Yeah, so consistently good. Canlander is a 100-card singleton deck, so cards that are good in other formats are not necessarily good here, because other formats, like 60-card 4 of formats, you can afford to play cards in which, like, they work together, such as Modern Scam is a good example, where it's much more consistent that you're going to have an Evoke creature and your Undying Evil in your opening hand, but that same combo doesn't really work in Canlander unless both of those cards are already a big part of your game plan, which is not very common. Another good example are, like, very specific hate pieces. Cards like Rest in Peace or like Leyline of the Void or something, like Graveyard Hate that doesn't do anything other than hate graveyards. Like, sure, it's going to be really, really good against Storm or Reanimator, but it's going to feel real bad to draw that against blue-white control.
Yeah. I do think that sometimes if you really want to get a card like that into your deck, for example, you know, I really want to play Rest in Peace because I really hate losing to this one deck that uses this graveyard, but it's a dead draw in so many other things. If you can find another use for those cards, sometimes you can justify putting them in your deck. I think the clearest example of that is when you talk about blue-white control playing Helm of Obedience combo and Enlightened Tutor. You know, it gets to have additional proactive value outside of just being interaction. So if it happens to be good in your metagame, Rest in Peace, then you could lean into the Helm combo where you're getting proactive value from winning the game with it. Now, that doesn't work for everything. That's, I think, only some things that works for. Like with Undying Evils, you know, maybe you can justify them if you're playing a pod deck where you're sacrificing a lot of stuff, but even then it's a little questionable. So I think you can do that, and you can justify playing cards that in a vacuum aren't amazing if you have a way to make them good, as that is good enough. But generally speaking, as Nicholas said, if it's just like a random hate piece, you probably don't want it.
Yeah, and that's why, like, either modal cards or cards that have additional value are really good. A good example is, like, say, Endurance. It's really, really good against graveyard decks, but it's also just a 3-mana flash 3/4 with reach that can come in and snipe a Vendilion Clique or just come in on the end step and swing in for 3 next turn and take the initiative. So it has, like,
That fourth toughness, man.
Yeah, the 3/4, it's really relevant, which me and Ash very incorrectly, I think, when that set was spoiled, I think we picked Endurance as the worst of the Evoke creatures.
I would like to go ahead and go on record saying that I disavow most of my statements from that episode. That is episode 2 of the podcast. We did a Modern Horizons 2 set review. And let's just say now we're talking about how we evaluate cards and, like, how what we think through. Back then, we didn't think about it, okay?
So basically, listen,
we were young, we were innocent.
We should have watched this episode before recording that episode.
Yes, that's what we should have done. So please go watch us. Roast us in our hashtag roast me channel on the Discord server. But you know, we were just kids.
I guess, to be fair, we did pick out some of the other evoke creatures as being really good, which that was accurate, so we weren't...
Solitude, I think we picked out that as the best one.
Yes, which...
I think I didn't read them all properly.
Solitude's pretty solid.
You know what? I'm gonna go ahead and make a minor defense for ourselves from episode 2. Listen, we took on the ambitious venture of reviewing, of looking at every card in the set to talk about, not just like the good ones. So that led me to not reading every card as thoroughly as I should have, and I apologize for that.
Yeah.
And, you know, Nicholas, he has no excuse. No, I'm kidding. It's the same excuse. So, anyways, consistently good. I think interaction is the type of thing that we talked about this earlier, where, you know, it seems like it could be fine in your deck. You know, it hits stuff, but is it good enough to be is it consistently good enough to justify a slot in your deck? We talked about this a little bit earlier with, like, you know, certain removal spells or threats. I think it comes up a lot with interaction because of the fact that a lot of interaction is, like, it has limitations on what it can and can't hit, such as counter spells that only hit CMC 2 or 3 or less, abrupt decay or fatal push type of removal spells that care about CMC. Burn spells that care about toughness, obviously, like, are they going to deal enough damage or not? That kind of thing, I think, is, it can be harder to tell when it's going to be good. I think a lot of people thought that Cut Down was going to be, well, actually, there was quite a debate when Cut Down came out. It's, if you don't know, it's one black mana, destroy target creature that has combined power and toughness 5 or less. And I think there was a lot of back and forth when that came out, because a lot of people thought, well, it doesn't hit enough, or a lot of people said, well, it hits just about everything you want to be hitting that fast. And I personally landed on the side of the argument where I don't think I would play it. I think Nicholas landed on the other side of that argument, actually. Is that true?
I tried it a few times. I didn't necessarily say that it was going to be great. But I still think in certain decks, like mono black decks, it's a good like role filler. For
the redundancy of one drop removal spells.
Yeah, but definitely, okay. If you're playing a deck that it kind of goes back to what we were talking about earlier. It's not like, for a lot of decks, it's not better than what you are already playing or what you already have access to.
You know, I think another good example of that, if we can go back to a previous bullet point, is in the last couple of years, a lot of Doomblades have come out. You know, one that hits things that aren't angels, demons, or demon imp or devil or something like that, or werewolf or dragon or something. I don't know.
I think it's
like some weird creature types.
Angel, demon, or it might, I don't know.
Like, you know, it had some specific creature types it couldn't hit. There's the one that you lose 2 life. There's the one that you, I think it's like a sorcery, but it's like a more or less universal removal spell, but they're all like one in a black, right? And you know, they see play in like Standard and Pioneer, where they're just kind of the cream of the crop. But if you look back to Highlander, we have a lot of other more efficient removal spells, especially once you're in 2 or more colors, that it's pretty hard to justify those effects over well, let's say Go for the Throat is gonna hit more often than not. Compared to, like, I guess what I'm trying to say is, if you take Go for the Throat as your kind of the gold standard most of the time, it's going to hit more things than is worth taking the 2 life from Power Word Kill, right?
Power Word Kill doesn't do 2 life.
What's the one that does 2 life from Midnight Hunt?
I don't know. Power Word Kill is the one you're talking about with angels, demons, devils, and dragons.
Okay. Well, sure. I guess. Well, okay. I think that the one that I don't know what it's called then. The black one. I think it must be from Midnight Hunt. You lose 2 life. Or maybe it's from AFR. My AFR is power word kill, probably. Doesn't matter. The one where you lose two life.
Power word kill is Dungeons and Dragons no. set.
Right, yeah, that's what I'm saying. The one from AFR, or sorry, the one from Midnight Hunt, where you lose two life, right? That one, I think that two life is going to come up way more than them having an artifact creature most of the time. You know, obviously, if you're in a meta game where a lot of people are playing like battle bots or affinity type decks, which happens, you know, that's a little unfortunate, and maybe that's a meta call you have to make, which we'll get to in a moment. But broadly speaking, if you're looking for just like your most blanket efficient removal, I think you're going to find yourself happy you have a go for the throat more often than the other one that I can't remember what it's called.
Yeah, I would agree. And that's kind of like that removal spell I brought up near the beginning of the episode where like it could be fine, but there's just better things.
Yeah. I think another, I guess this is kind of the next bullet point here, is talking about how consistently good your threats are. And when Nicholas and I were talking about this bullet point ahead of time, I think I was thinking of it from a slightly wrong lens, which is more meta-dependent. So we're going to talk a little more about the meta stuff a little lower. Right now, we just want to talk about, Nicholas gave the example, if you're going into a tournament where the metagame is pretty blind for you, would you want to play this or not? And so I think when we're evaluating threats, we want to think of, in the broader metagame, you know, it's not your weekly, you know what all your friends have, but it is what do, like, what is a lot of the metagame play, and is this going to be good or not against it? You want to elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah. So, like, there's a lot of it's, like, specific hate pieces. Mirren Crusader is something I brought up earlier with Ash, which is, like, It used to see some play, and still maybe a few decks play it, but in a blind metagame, it doesn't do enough to justify including it. Another example of a newer one is, what's it called?
Oh, you forgot the name.
Clawed Raptor. It was another thing that was brought up in the Discord as a new card. And it's 2 and a red for a 4/3 dinosaur, and it says whenever a player casts a spell, unless it's that player's turn, it deals 4 damage to that player. And, like, at first it seems, like, pretty decent. Like, it's got a decent body against, like, control. It's probably pretty good. But you have to think about it just in general. Like, if you play this against a mid-range deck, it's not a better threat than, like, it's not a better body than any, like, a lot of the other 3 drops that you're playing. And the additional effect is super easy to play around. Like, it's they just wait until their main phase, and then they lightning bolt it. And you're like, oh, okay, I just spent 3 mana and didn't really get anything out of it. As opposed to, like, a lot of the much better 3 mana threats that, like, are either hasty or provide additional value immediately. And so you need to think of threats in a blind metagame, not just, like, against one or two certain decks that exist. And I guess the slight caveat to this would be if it really hoses a deck and if you can find it consistently. And when I say that, I'm of course thinking of Collector Oof, which kind of falls into that category of only being good against certain decks. I mean, against other decks, it's fine as just a bear. But if you're playing a deck like Pod or some sort of creature toolbox deck that can consistently find it, it might still be worth it just to ensure a win against like those artifact decks. Because as someone that has been on both sides of a Collector Oof, having played it somewhat often and played against it somewhat often, it's real good against the decks that it's good against.
I would have to agree with that. So, where's our next point? This is actually more or less the top or the post in our Discord that kind of prompted us to talk about this, which is the nature of high roll cards. You know, a lot of decks like fast mana, like Moxes and Mox Dime. It's also a Mox, I guess. Like Soul Ring, Mana Crypt type stuff. And that's well and good. And I think it's pretty established that those effects can be very good. But it's also because most of them, their downside isn't that bad. But if you look at the card Gemstone Caverns, that one kind of has a lot of hoops to jump through for it to be worth it. In the event that you don't know what Gemstone Caverns is, it is a legendary land that comes into play. It comes into play like a ley line before the game starts if you are on the draw and it is in your opening hand. So if you're not on the play and it's in your opening hand, it can come into play with a luck counter on it and tap for any color mana. Otherwise, it's just a waste if you don't have it come into play before the game starts.
And if so, it comes in with a luck counter on it, you have to exile a card from your hand.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, that's very important. Forgot about that part.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of hoops you have to jump through for it to do anything. And I've heard it described as this card seals the playback, because if you're on the play, you're down a card, up a land. Because you get to go first. But this kind of, you're down a card, but you're up a land. So, the discussion kind of came to, most decks would not want this, but decks that don't really care if you just have a wastes might want this. Which is not that many decks want to be playing wastes, but, you know, it's here. I personally think there's very few decks that would want it. Maybe medium red would be okay with that. I think it's like okay if you're doing like the Thought Not Seer, where you want to be playing some number of colorless lands. Aside from that, I'm not so sure. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree, because the problem with Gemstone Caverns is, like I said, there's a lot of hoops you have to jump through, and there's like a lot of criteria for what decks want this. And by the time you've narrowed those all down, like checked all of the boxes for decks that want Gemstone Caverns, you're left with like one or two decks that maybe are okay with having it in the list. Like I said, medium red is a good example of a deck that might want it, but even medium red, like, you want your wastes to be doing something else. And while this does technically do something else, it only does something else if it's in your opening hand, and if you're on the draw, and if you have a card in your hand that you're willing to pitch. And so, especially in a deck like medium red, which is already mulliganing pretty aggressively, you can find yourself in a lot of situations in which you have this in your opening hand after like a mull to five, and you might just not even want to play it on the draw, because medium red, like, it mulligans really well, but it still, like, it needs the cards that it mulligans to, because it needs, like, the land, the fast mana, the threat. And when your fast mana is putting you card negative, you want it to be really good, and Gemstone Caverns is just not consistently really good.
Yeah. I think, like, the closest comparison is Mox Diamond, or Chrome Mox, rather. I guess, really, pretty good. More so Chrome Mox, probably. But, like, if I'm mulliganing to if I'm mulliganing to five, I would rather have a Chrome Mox than a Mox Diamond. Or sorry, than a, well, I probably would. But I guess that depends on what my hand looks like. But I would rather have a Chrome Mox than a Gemstone Caverns, because I think that you are more likely to get additional value out of that Chrome Mox, especially because medium red has been playing a couple cards that let you sack artifacts now. But it's just, you're more likely to get wastelanded than, shattered, I think. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. And I don't even think that's necessarily the biggest reason to be on it. I think the biggest problem is Chrome Mox, like, you have a lot more flexibility. Like, Gemstone Caverns gives you very little flexibility.
You can Chrome Mox on turn two.
Yeah. You can Chrome Mox, like,
or on the play
after, like, honestly, you could Chrome Mox on, like, turn three or four. Like, let's say turn four you play your land and you have a five drop you want to play. Like, you can wait until you've drawn a card that you don't need or like don't want to cast, And honestly, like, there's sometimes, like, some decks where Chromox, you're fine it just being an artifact, like, to enable Metalcraft or Affinity or something like that. And so Gemstone Caverns, it's so much more narrow, and it has the same downside as Chromox without the consistency of it, because Chromox is good on the play, good on the draw, fine drawing it late. Like, if you draw a Gemstone Caverns on turn one, you're just really sad. If you draw a Chromox on turn one, you're like, oh, cool. Now I'm like, I'm doing things.
Oh, I've accelerated my game by a turn.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Nick, I didn't prepare you for this, but I was wondering if, I guess we still have to talk about, metagame. All right, we'll come back to this after we talk about metagame.
Just gonna leave me hanging. All right, we'll talk about
metagame. Okay, I'll give you a moment to prepare. I was gonna say we can go through some of our new cards. I mean, we already talked about some of them, but some of the cards have been posted in the new cards channel, and I want to hear your thoughts as an evaluation.
All right,
but let's talk about our last bullet point here, which is metagaming in the meta board, which I've coined this term just now. Surely someone else said that, but I'm saying it now. It's the meta board, where a lot of cards that I think this is more often for cards that used to be staples or used to be very commonly played, but it's reevaluating them for your current metagame. Sometimes it's not about just not playing them, but it's about holding out for appropriate metagames for them. I think a lovely example we already talked about was the card Mirren Crusader. Where certain metagames you don't want that at all. But if your metagame is like Jund and blue-black control, you know, Mirren Crusader is going to be a wonderful addition to your creature suite. But if you're playing against nothing but Storm and Pod, you know, Mirren Crusader is not going to be quite as valuable to you. Do you have any other
examples? Yeah, I would agree. And I think even like with the meta board, you still want to try to pick cards that have some amount of flexibility, but you can be a lot more narrow on that flexibility. So like I said, Mirren Crusader is a good example because
It still attacks for four.
Yeah, it's still a 2/2 a double strike, which like I said, it's really good against like the Rock or Jund or Abzan, but if you're playing against blue white control, it's not doing much.
1/1 still block the same.
Yeah.
I feel like it's a little harder to evaluate when interaction is as good, but like Spell Snare and Cut Down, they can be a little tougher to tell when they're going to be great, but like, you know, if you're looking at a metagame that's playing a lot more early cantripping or moxes, even spell pierce could be pretty good. But if it's a lot more mana dorks and just land drop mana dork into a three drop, you know, you might be better with cut down effects where stifling your mana dorks early is valuable. That's just a very small example of that, of course. But I think interaction can be a lot tougher because it's much more about a direct response than a soft response, such as Mirren Crusader.
Yeah.
Because it's still a Mirren Crusader, at the end of the day, is still proactive.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think interaction can be a lot harder to really determine what's going to be better. But, you know, I think you still need to put interaction in your maybe, or your meta board.
Yeah, I would agree. And like, as with pretty much anything, the best way to determine if a card is going to be good or not is just try it out. Like I said, I tried Cut Down a few times when it came out. Like, if you're not sure about a card, put it in your deck and be very like, anytime you play it or draw it, very consciously think about how good does this feel right now. Do I want to cast this? And then once you cast it, is it doing anything? And you can usually pretty quickly kind of weed out what's good, what's bad, just by doing that.
All right. Well, now, okay, so like I was saying, I haven't really prepped you on this, but seeing as both of us have, for various reasons, I haven't played in a little bit, I was wondering if in place of doing our last time we played, we do a little example of some card evaluation. What do you think?
That's fine with me. I mean, I was going to talk about Medium Blue and the glories of it, but I'm good with doing that too.
All right, well, let's start with this card right here someone posted. It is called Groving Rites of Illamok, which is confusing.
That's not a new card.
Wait a minute. I swear there was a flip green card. Am I crazy? All right, this card right here.
It is called a flip green card. But...
No, okay. Editor, feel free to cut that out. Anyways, this card is called Permission Denied. It is a white and a blue for an instant. It says counter target non-creature spell. Your opponents can't cast non-creature spells this turn.
I think it's going to be pretty good in specifically. Let's go through our checklist. Does it go straight into something? Probably not straight into anything.
I'd agree.
Does it support a deck's game plan? It supports the game plan of blue-white. Especially blue white being a deck that already kind of struggles against storm type decks, it could be pretty good in there. And blue white's already playing at least Dovin's Veto, and then sometimes also negate. So if nothing else, this replaces negate in those decks. And then does it birth a new deck? Definitely not. Is it consistently good? And that's kind of where like this card is judged at, and I would say yes, because there are almost zero decks in Canlander that are not on a pretty decent number of non-creature spells. Like even Pod and stuff, you're playing a lot of like tutors, and so even just ignoring the second line, the first line is just good enough that the decks that already were wanting negate type effects, it fills in the role of negate while also just sometimes hosing certain decks. And then meta dependent, it's really good in certain metas.
Is that your full evaluation?
My full evaluation.
Okay, I have two comments. First off, I mostly agree. I think the card is going to see play, and I think it's going to see success. Two things. One is it seems good against Storm. It's actually extremely good against Storm, because the big thing about blue-white versus Storm is the matchup's terrible for blue-white, because what happens is you don't present a threat fast enough, and then your opponent has a million years to set up and find silence, and then if you counter the silence, they just wait till next turn, and if you don't counter the silence, you just they kill you. So having more cheap interaction that is hard counter to silence is big. That's big. The other thing is, if they aren't silencing you, usually what they're going to do is they're going to let you counter their spell, and then they're just going to find a way to recast it in the same turn. That's what usually happens. So what's going to happen with this is what you can do is you can let them go off a little bit, and then you can hit something in the middle of them trying to go off, and then normally they would just let it get countered and then cast it again, but this stops them and then makes them use all their resources. Does that sound about right?
Yeah. And so two things about to go off of your second point, Storm gets really hosed by this. If it plays its Underworld Breach and then casts like a Brain Freeze and then you just counter the Brain Freeze, that's really bad for them because their Underworld Breach sacks on instep and then they're just screwed. But another thing, so Ash had said like they cast a silence and if you counter it, they just wait till next turn. But sometimes they don't even have to do that. Like if they cast a silence and you like tap out to counter it, they can just wait till next turn. But if you're tapped out, like they could also just go off knowing that even if you have like a Force of Will, they have enough to play through it. But if you use this to counter their silence, you ensure that you get another untap step where you have mana up again, and then they have to be able to interact with you again before they can go off.
Now, another thing is, if they play an Underworld Breach, and then they cast a Brain Freeze, Do you cast this in response to the storm trigger, or do you let the storm trigger resolve? What I mean is, if you cast this and then counter the original, the storm trigger will resolve, but they can't cast them. Off the storm?
Yeah.
So, like, do you let them mill themselves?
No, you don't let them mill themselves.
Even if their brain freeze goes away? Or their breach?
Yeah, because it's not exiled. It just goes to their graveyard. So, like let's say you let them mill themselves and they mill over Savine's reclamation. That feels really awkward.
Oh, yeah, then you're totally wrecked. Yeah, you're right. Okay, and then the other comment I wanted to make about this is I feel like Blue-White Control is already playing two negates. It is playing Dovin's Veto, and it is playing Force and Negation. It rarely plays actual negate, unfortunately, because I love negate, but it's just not. You usually don't want three negates. So the question is this good enough to justify playing three negates? And I feel like that is a meta question.
Yeah.
Because this might be controversial and it might be wrong, and I'm going to say it, and you know what? Leave a comment. I feel like, at least in my thinking right now, is if you are wanting the can't be countered aspect of Dovin's Veto bad enough, you're going to play all three of these. But if you are only going to play two, you might play this instead of Dovin's Veto, because it could be more relevant than, especially against combo decks, than Dovin's Veto will be, because most combo decks aren't countering you back.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, I can agree with that. And like I said, I think it's kind of meta dependent. But that being said, I guess like the thing is, this is good against the same decks that Dovin's Veto is.
Yeah.
While also being good against other decks. Like, you like to see this
with the exception. Control. Well, I mean, yeah, you do, but you'd rather have Dovin's Veto so you can resolve your Teferi. Actually, it doesn't matter, because they just let their thing account.
It's more so they can't resolve their Teferi.
Yeah, oh, no, that's what I meant. I think that's an example of how we evaluate cards. And maybe this one was a bit of an obvious one. That's possible. I just kind of picked one at random. Well, at first I picked, maybe the editor removed that, so we're not going to talk about it. But I hope that was a good enough example of how our thought process typically works. Do you have any closing comments?
I don't think so.
Okay, well, everybody, please have some wonderful discussions as the next set gets spoiled soon, whenever that is. Maybe, I don't know if I'm dating this, I don't know. If the next set gets spoiled soon, I hope that we it has some good discussion about some new cards coming out. Hope you all have a lovely time, and may you draw well.
Yep. Thanks for listening.
See you around.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the 10 Points Podcast, and don't forget to count your points.